Imagine being told at 6 years old that you'll never play sport again.
Well, Anthony Bryan was told just that, but he went on to win international gold medals.
And we're going to be speaking to him today. Welcome to TRC Meets, where we get incredible running stories that you may never have heard. You're going for marathon world records, but I want to know, if you could go back and talk to your six-year-old self, what would you say to them?
So I was very shy, self-conscious, and thought I didn't have much hope of a life, a future in my life, because after my brain tumour, I was wheelchair bound, and I was told you probably won't walk or be very active again. So it'd be good to go back and say to him, don't worry, keep doing what you're doing, because you're doing the right things. And I was lucky that I had competitive brothers, so I always had to compete against them to help me. I had to push myself to walk. I had to push myself to run. Otherwise, you can't let your siblings win, really.
No, absolutely. And can you just talk to us? So what happened when you were six, and how did that completely change your life?
So I was just your very happy, active, sporty child, always running around, always playing football, loved football. I then started to get really bad headaches, and became very lethargic. Mm. And I used to curl up into a ball and just hold my head, because it was like a screaming inside my head. My parents took me to the doctors, and the doctors just thought it was migraines, so sent me on my way with a bit of paracetamol. But as the weeks went on, these headaches got worse. And after doing a brain scan, they found I had a brain tumour the size of a tennis ball. And what they found was this brain tumor was shutting down my vital organs. So they had to operate immediately, as soon as possible, to remove this tumor. It was supposed to be just a routine operation to remove this tumor. But when they removed it, I suffered a stroke. So I lost the use of my left side. I was bedbound, wheelchair bound, and obviously told, you may not walk ever again, you may not do this ever again. And when you're six, that's kind of
how do you deal with that? How does a six-year-old deal with that?
Soul destroying. My whole childhood was hospital appointments, physio appointments. Yeah. And all I wanted to do was run around and play football and play games. One of the hardest things was when, after about a year, eventually I was allowed to go back to school, but the teachers were too worried about me going outside in the playground. So at playtime, I just sit in the classroom watching outside the window, all my friends running around playing football. And at like 6, 7 years old, I began to think, I wish I'd never survived this operation. Why am I still here? And I began to like hate myself, embarrassed of myself. I was the only disabled kid in the whole school. Mm. Yeah, so.
And I guess that's something people don't think about. It's not just access that you need in order to be able to get outside, but also having people around you who would giving you the confidence to go do that? Because the teacher saying, oh no, you can't go do that, did that then rub off on you? Because I'm guessing before that moment you were, you know, confident, wanting to go outside and be with your friends. But then if people day after day are telling you that, how does that make you feel?
They'll tell you, you can't do this, you can't do that. So you then kind of start to believe it. But I was very stubborn. I was very like, I'll show you, I can do it.
Yeah,
I will do it.
Yeah.
Was that all sports, or was it running at that point already, you were thinking?
So football was my thing.
Yeah.
One memory I have of school was we had a PE lesson, and back then, like, teachers didn't know much about disabilities. I was the only disabled kid in the whole school. So we had a football lesson, and I was like, I'll go in goal. I can't run around much, but I'll go in goal. And the teacher said to me, you can't go in goal. You need two hands to go in goal. So I stayed away from sport after that.
Mm. When did it change? What was the point where it changed?
It wasn't until
I can do this and I will.
It wasn't until I joined a disability football team at Tottenham Hotspur, and coaches started telling me, yeah, you might not be able to do this, but you can do this. Don't focus on what you can't do. Let's focus on what you can do. And they told me, like, I've got because I can only use one side, I have an extra strong right arm, an extra strong right leg. So whenever I'd strike a ball, I'd have the most powerful shot out of everyone. And it was actually my PE teacher at school. We was doing a Cooper test, which is 12-minute running. See how far you can get in 12 minutes. And I just remember thinking, I cannot come last. I cannot let the overweight, lazy kids beat me in this. I just, they'd be too embarrassing for me. So I just pushed myself and just kept running. And that 30 in the class, I came like 15th. And wow. I was the only disabled one. And the teacher said to me, "That was incredible." And she said, "Have you ever thought about going into the Paralympics?" I was like, "No, what's the Paralympics?" She said, "It's like the Olympics, but for people with disabilities. You would be amazing at it." But I was so self-conscious of myself and embarrassed of myself. My reaction was, "That's something I definitely don't want to do. Why would I want to do something that shows off my disability?" I was trying to hide it as it was.
And when did you feel like you wanted to stop hiding it and get out there and think about, well, quite frankly, gold medals?
It is a long time. So I went along to the running club. So the teacher spoke to my parents, who's like, "Just get him in a running club."
Right.
So my parents put me down. Again, I was the only disabled kid in the whole running club. And I went, the coach was like, "I've never coached someone with a disability, but I'm willing to give it a go. Let's learn and see where we can go." And I was like, "I can't keep up with them, but just give me something to do." So she gave me running to do. And then after a few months, she was like, "There's no need to do it on your own. Just do it with everyone else. Do the same session." So I started doing the same sessions as the able-bodied athletes. I was behind, but they were so encouraging to me. And that made me feel good about myself. And then as I started running faster, I started winning medals in competitions. And in 2012, I got to the Paralympic trials at the Olympic Stadium. And I remember there's about 5,000 people watching. And it just, this was incredible. It was actually, I volunteered at the London Olympics and the Paralympics. And for once, I just saw this 80,000 people crowd going crazy for people with disabilities.
Yeah.
And I was like, I said to the guy, one of the guys I was working with, I was like, "Why are people louder for the Paralympics more than the Olympics?" And he said, "Well, if you think about it, the Paralympics is way more impressive than the Olympics because the Paralympians are doing the same amount of training, the same amount of work, the same diet, but they have to do it with added difficulty. Yeah, the Olympians train hard, but they don't have that added difficulty every single day." I was like, "Oh, I never thought of it like that."
And can you talk a little bit about, so you're training right now for the London Marathon.
Yeah.
Very exciting. How does your disability impact training for that? Like, can you talk us through a kind of typical week of running?
So I can only use the one side of my body. So 50% of my body I can't use. So when I'm running, my right side does all the work. Mm-hmm. And what I've found, I can run 5K, I can run 10K, but I've conditioned myself to do that. What I found now is after 13 miles, my left side just gives up. And I don't know how it's going to go after 20 miles, but I've gone up to 18 miles now and I was literally dragging my left side.
And why have you decided to go from, you know, 10K half marathons to a full marathon distance when you know what this is going to do to your body? You know how hard it is. You've talked to us, you told me and Sarah how difficult it is for you basically to drag half of your body along with you.
Yeah.
Why?
I think Rick's getting at, wouldn't. Try and convince Rick to train for a marathon.
Well, I started off as a sprinter doing 100 meters and 200 meters. And I thought it was impossible to do 1500 meters and 800 meters. And I ended up being the world champion in 1500 and 800. And I just kind of thought, back then I thought I'd never even walk. How much more capable am I? What more can I do? And then I did a 10K and I did a 10K and I thought that was impossible. I was like, I didn't find out I can do this. I was like, how much further can I go? Then I did a half and then I was like, can I go further?
Yeah.
This is like the unknown. I just want to keep pushing myself and just learning new boundaries. And it motivates me to kind of want to train harder and push myself. And what I found was by me finding new things, it inspires other people with disabilities as well.
Completely. So talk me through the strength work that you've got to do in order to train for marathons, because in the smallest comparison, me and you both have a drop foot, and you know I've got used to over the years to wearing a brace and kind of knowing how to drag my foot forward, because it's the propulsion, isn't it, when you can't lift your foot.
Yeah.
So is that what that means, that you can't lift your toes?
You can't lift your toes and the bottom of your foot. And I got mine through a rugby injury as a teenager. And how is it for you? Like, how do you get that propulsion of pulling your body through when you know it involves so much strength to do it?
A lot of core work.
Mm.
My biggest issue is probably my hip flexors, because my hip flexors pull my leg up. And so my right leg is doing all the kicking and all the pulling.
Yeah.
I have to like propel myself in the air so I can swing my left leg through. I'd have to slow it down on the video for you to really see it. But when I'm running, it looks like I'm just galloping.
Really?
Yeah. So I kind of gallop with my right side, pull the left. And I have to wear a prosthetic brace on my left leg to hold my ankle in place. Otherwise, the ankle just gives way every time I run. And it's made of carbon fiber. So after running, it rubs against the skin. And literally a few weeks ago, it burnt a big hole in the back of my heel.
Yeah.
So now I've got...
Because do you have much feeling down that? Is that all literally?
It's actually extra sensitive, yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. So you can feel it. It's not like it would rub for the whole marathon and then you just wouldn't
feel it. Yeah. I will feel it. Yeah.
You'll feel it.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with, is that something that you've had to adjust to in training?
Yeah. So I've had to find new inventive ways of stopping it. So I find silicone is very soft, very cushiony. So I put Compeat plaster on the injury, on the blister or the hole. Then I'll get silicone heels, mm-hmm. which would just go over the foot. And then I found silicone socks, which go over the top of that. Then to stop the toes getting black and bashed up because they get battered, you can get toe guards, which are silicone. They're extra protected so they don't rip. So all of these things are super, but it squashes my foot into the shoe then.
Yes, and then you having to get like right shoe true to size, left shoe.
That is my biggest problem, yeah.
Really?
So my right foot's maybe a size 9 and a half.
Yeah.
My left foot would have to be a 10 or more because of all the brace in there. And
yeah.
Because it does get very squashed in there, but they don't kind of make shoes. So when I was a child, I had to buy two pairs of shoes just for 2 feet. So I had to buy
a 9 and a half and a 10 and a half. Yeah.
So extra expensive. But even from finding silicone things on my feet and chatting to other runners, they're like, oh my God, I could use some of that as well. So it kind of helps others.
Yeah, true. You're getting all the hacks. I feel like there will be loads of like ultra runners listening to this as well, going like, interesting, I haven't tried that before.
Yeah.
Sarah and I are just fascinated by also the role of the support runner in many of the races. And I know you're really keen to talk about how valuable they are as well. Mm. And you've been running with the same support runner, haven't you, recently on a couple of your races?
So it's called the Richard Whitehead Foundation, and they supply support runners for people with disabilities.
Yeah.
And last year I entered a 10 mile. That was my furthest ever run. And Richard said to me, do you want a support runner? I was like, yeah, that would help. So me and this guy Tyler met on that day, and we'd never met before. And he's just like, tell me what you need. Cause I've lost 50% of my vision as well. I've got tunnel vision. So I can't see people either side of me. And quite often I just run past water stations without even realizing they're there. So he kind of helps me by getting the water, unscrewing it, and then helping me run along. Things like tie my shoelaces. I can't tie shoelaces one hand. So he was a big help to me. And at the end of the run, he was like, I absolutely love that. I really enjoyed that. And he's like, what's the next one?
Oh, really?
Nice. So I feel like that is one thing with running where, like, in any other situation, if you had to meet a stranger and like be with them for like a 10 mile or half marathon, like an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, it would be like, oh gosh, this is gonna be really awkward. Whereas with running, it could be anyone in the world. And as soon as you start running, I just feel like you find things to talk about. Well, and like literally by the end of it, you're best of friends.
I mean, I wouldn't talk to anyone.
Oh yeah. I recently paced Rick for a 5K.
We didn't
just
speak.
Talked at him.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
But it was like basically the quietest half hour we've ever had together.
Yeah. So have you done more runs with Tyler afterwards as well?
So after that, we're like, let's do a half marathon. So we did the half. That was really good. And then he was like, so he had a really bad experience when he did the London Marathon, like 10 years before. He wanted to go sub 3 hours, and he pushed it so hard that he collapsed on mile 24 or something like that. And he ended up in the back of the ambulance. And he said, I will never, ever do a marathon again. And then he met me and he's like...
Unless it's as a support runner.
This is his story.
Someone I really, really like.
Is that I've never said I'd do it again, but since meeting Ant, we're going for it.
Oh, no. So he's going to be running with you.
So we've gone on this whole kind of journey together.
Yeah.
Mm. And are you training together as well?
Well, he lives in Brighton, so...
Oh, right, a bit far.
He'll do his run and then he'll put it on Strava and tag me in and he'll go, your turn now, Ant, off you go.
Nice.
Yeah, so we kind of keep each other accountable.
Yeah.
But what was nice was we'd never even met each other that day. And then when we ran that 10 mile, we were just chatting. He was like, tell me your story. And that's how we got to know each other through the run, which is kind of like new for me because every other run I've done from athletics, you have to go out hard and you don't talk to anyone and until your lungs burst. So running kind of slower and marathon training is a new kind of thing. You get talking to other runners and you make friends along the way.
Yeah, it is. So I did Chicago Marathon last year and I helped one of our presenters, Tom, do it, his first ever marathon. And I'd never looked at a marathon like that before, but it is like you're in this really weird like house that's 26 miles long and like a house party and you just keep bumping into people and being like, and we had some incredible chats with people where you're like with them for maybe a mile, 2 miles, and then you run off or they run off and then you bump into the next person. But it's like you're all self-contained within that one road and just chatting to each other and having the best time ever.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to like meeting new people and just having chats along the way.
Yeah, it's going to be so good.
Well, I didn't say anything the whole time. I did the whole marathon. Never spoke to anyone. Didn't even speak to myself.
Did you not?
Yeah. I barely knew what day it was by the end.
Some say he's still running.
Yeah.
And so can you tell us the aspiration for London is to get a Guinness World Record?
Yes.
What's that world record for?
So it's the fastest marathon with a disability. So the disability category is hemiplegia. So one side of the body, you can't use one side of the body.
Mm-hmm. And what's the time that you have to hit?
So the time is 5 hours and 50 minutes. And I really want to get under 5 hours.
Nice.
Yeah.
And how's the training been going for that?
Really hard. So I did the 10 miles and I did that in like 1 hour 30. I thought I can keep 9 minute miles.
Yeah.
And then I did the half, I did 13 miles and I kept 9 minute miles. But after that, you don't realize the further you go, it just kind of smacks you in the face. It's like, you can't go that fast. It will total up on you. So me and Tyler, let's sit down. It's like, okay, so let's slow it down to 10 minute miles. That'll give you 4 hours 30, more realistic, gives you that reserve energy in the bank if we need it. So I'm going to try and get between 4 hours 30 and 5 hours.
Amazing.
What's your running faux pas, Ant? Like, what are the things that you do wrong and you know you do wrong? Do you go off too fast? Because if you're aiming for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I feel like a previous sprinter.
Yeah. If you're aiming for track athlete, you go. And I did that. I used to do that on all my runs. And I've got a wicked sprint finish. So when we did the half marathon, we did 9 minute mile, 9 minute all the way. And then the last mile, I think I did like 6:05.
Oh my
God. So I was 6:05
for a mile.
Yeah.
But you've got to be measured. You've got to be ruthless. And you've got to be skilled to keep to that 10 minute a mile. Because you know that you'll feel good at the beginning, but you know your body, and you know that your body actually it hasn't done this yet, has it?
Exactly.
No.
So there are questions for you about whether or not you can do it.
Yeah.
I suppose the discipline of saying, hang on a second, I need to stick to these numbers is far more pertinent, far more important for you than it is for Sarah.
But that's my biggest downfall as well. If I had run this on my own, I'd just be going like, oh, that was 8 minutes. I need to go faster. Or I'd be like 20 seconds out. I need to kick it up. It's Tyler who keeps me under control. So you know when you have someone go past you and you're like, no, I'm not letting that happen.
Yeah.
My biggest bugbear is runners with buggies. And I'm like, there's no way they can go faster than me. So if one of them goes past me, I'm normally like, I'm going to get them back.
Oh yeah, I have the same rule. I just say I won't let them lap me.
Yeah. They've gone now. If they come round again, it's not a lapped course, but if they come round.
Just not the second lap.
If you have an 80-year-old going past you, it's like, no.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be a really fast 80-year-old.
Yeah. With London as well, because there's so much fancy dress. That's what I keep getting people commenting, being like, good session, but go a bit faster if you don't want a banana to overtake you.
Oh, I completely agree. It was the moment when Jesus Christ on the cross overtook me on the mound that I thought,
are you sure that wasn't
maybe this hasn't gone to plan?
Are you sure you weren't hallucinating at that point?
Potentially. A couple of bottles in.
And I want to know, so the hardest bit of the marathon, as you said, like what I find incredible about marathons, and I don't know if I'm on my own here, but I actually find the first half boring. Because just because you've got so far to go, and like in training, you've obviously, like, you've run 10 miles and you've run half marathons multiple times, until I get to half marathon, I'm like, just waiting for
Sarah,
the hard
bit. You're just disgustingly fit.
No, as in, it's still
you find
hard.
The first half of a marathon boring.
Because I'm like,
I'm just trying to stay alive.
But you get past the halfway point and it gets hard. You haven't done it, so I don't want to scare you. But I want to know, because you've been through so much, do you actually find that in the parts of races where it is really hard, do you find actually your mental resilience is good? Or do you still feel like, no, when the wall comes, the wall comes?
I kind of don't give myself an option. Stopping's not an option.
Mm. Nice.
One of my biggest inspirations was David Goggins. And I read his book during lockdown, and I'm reading the second one at the moment. And one of the most inspiring, I think, chapters I read was the 40% rule. When you think you're down and out and you have no energy left, you're actually only 40% done. You have 60% to tap into. You just have to push and push through those pain barriers, push through that wall, and you have 60% that you didn't even realize you had. And I tried that. I went to training and I pushed myself really hard. Mm. And I thought, I can't go anymore. But I just remembered, there's that extra percentage that if you give up, you'll never find that extra percentage. But when you keep pushing through that, you'll find the brain unlocks this extra chamber that you'd never even used before. And you start finding out what you can really do.
My 60% is in a battery pack.
Can you imagine your life now if running wasn't in it?
I think if I wasn't into running, I'd be more into just gym. Because I've always been into fitness. And I think I'm always into fitness because I was embarrassed of my disability and where I look. So the first reason I went to the gym was because I need to look fit, because I'm disabled. I have to look fitter than everyone else because I'm already at a disadvantage. Mm. Mm-hmm. So I need to look stronger and better and fitter than everyone else. So I just kept going gym. And then running made me feel good about myself. Especially, I do talks in schools to inspire kids, and my PowerPoint presentation, I show them pictures of 10 years difference when I did my first ever athletics race. And what I used to do is I used to hate wearing vests because it showed the muscle imbalance. So I've got one really small arm and one really muscly arm, and wearing vests shows that off. So I used to wear long sleeve tops underneath my vest to try and hide it. And so that's one of my very first pictures. And then next to it, I've got a 10 years later picture. And it's me in just a vest representing England, looking very strong, very muscly, running the final in the 1500 meters. And I said, this took me 10 years to build the confidence not to wear that top underneath. So it took me a long time to try and build that confidence. And running's what built my confidence, what got the confidence out of me, because it made me feel good about myself. I was going from just a disabled person living your average life to now being a world champion. And that's what made me feel good about myself.
I want to ask you a similar question then. 6-year-old you, who doesn't know that all of this is to come, if you went and showed him where you are now, what do you think he'd say?
This is something I always said to myself growing up. If that 6-year-old had a time traveling machine and went to the future, I want that 6-year-old to look at me and think, wow, is that me? So that's why I always try to push myself to achieve new things. Because I don't want that 6-year-old to go into the future and look at me and think, oh, is that what I've got to look forward to? I really want to like make that child proud of life.
I feel like that's so relatable for like so many people as well, though.
Anyone, yeah.
Because it's like, I always love the phrase, like, there are two types of people in the world, those who work to live and those who live to work. But I feel like that's so representational of like your whole life, of like, if anyone right now, if you could see 10 years into the future, what would you go, oh, is that actually my life? Mm. Versus what could you achieve? And then it's like with running. It's like perfect kind of matches up to the same of like, set those goals of like, what's a goal? What would you go into the future and be like, sick, that's my life. That is absolutely incredible. What's the middle one of like, okay, this is very achievable, but I'd be very happy with that. And then what's like the bare minimum standard? And so 10 years from now, what do you want you to see if you went into a time traveling machine?
He's going to be doing ultras, isn't he?
I don't know. Someone mentioned that to me. But someone actually said to me, oh, have you heard of the Big Six? The Big Six marathons, and you get this giant medal. And straight, I was like, oh, interesting.
You know, it seemed to be 7 as well, potentially.
Really?
What's the add-on? Is it Cape Town?
It's either Cape Town or Sydney, from memory. Okay. They're about to add to
super hot as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't do well with heat.
No, me neither. It's bad enough running a marathon, let alone
I could run any weather in London marathon. It's, please don't be a heat wave.
Yeah, that
rain, fine.
Yeah.
Wind, okay. Yeah. But heat.
Just a dry, clear day. I feel like we've all worked hard enough for like one dry, clear day.
Every training run I've done so far, it's just been pouring of rain.
It's horrible. Yeah, I mean, we're well trained for rain at this point.
Yeah.
And was there one moment through all this journey to go in for, you know, world records at some of the world's biggest marathons? Was there one moment from 6-year-old you to now where you went, right, I've cracked it?
Well, when I won the gold medals and became world champion, that was a big proud moment for me. And that actually made me realize, am I more capable than I think I am? And that's when I started doing longer distances. Then every time I did longer distance, I finished it and I didn't think I could. Now this is kind of the next step. Every time I've gone into a run, I thought, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can do this. But then I end up smashing it and completing it. I'm in that stage in a marathon now. I don't know if I can do it when it gets to the hard last 10 miles. I don't know.
Mm. Do you still find it difficult to see that you inspire other people and younger people who might want to be out there running long distance? Does that still feel uncomfortable?
I'd get totally shocked that people look up to me and inspired by me. I think I went back to my old school to do a talk, and I was like, I was where you kids were what once was, and I was a disabled kid in the school. Now I'm a world champion. So if I can do it, then you guys can really achieve anything you want.
Yeah.
And I find 6-year-olds, that from what we were talking before, if they got a time machine into the future, 6-year-olds, they're full of all these big, bright ideas. I want to be this, I want to be that. And it's kind of life that, as you get older, life kind of puts you in your box and says, you can't do this, you can't do it. You kind of lose that kind of imagination. So I think just going for it.
Do you know what? When we decided that we were going to do this program, this feature, this new podcast, we were looking for inspirational people and people who were different and people who'd found a running journey that inspired others to be better and get something out of it that isn't just, you know, getting out every day and doing it for a reason. And I think you're exactly why we're doing it. So it's really great what you're doing. You might not realize it, but it's magnificent. It's amazing.
It's definitely going to help me on race day.
Yeah.
Thinking about, I think so often, so many people tell themselves, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Yeah.
But it is like people like you who inspire people to go, no, I can finish it. I can get to the line. And you do a lot of work with people now to get people active. Is it with adults?
Yes. So I teach, I'm a fitness instructor in the gym, and it took me a long time to get a job in the gym. So I qualified as a personal trainer in 2011, and I passed all my exams, and the teachers were like, you're going to go on to do amazing things and inspire loads of people and do this and do that. But every job interview I went to, I got turned down, and I went over to 30 job interviews, and they were like, oh, you haven't got the image we're looking for. you can't lift weights with two hands, so how do you expect to teach others?
Gosh.
So again, I could have let that beat me down and then just give up. But I was like, no, I'll go and get job experience, work experience. I went to the biggest gym in London, the YMCA, and I was like, I need work experience. I want to train me and show me how. So they took me on. They taught me how to teach exercise classes. I was really shy and self-conscious, so even talking to people was a struggle. But they taught me to teach exercise classes, and my exercise class ended up being one of the busiest in the gym. And still, even though I proved I could do it, I was still getting turned down from gyms, not getting jobs. And every time I went to a gym, I never saw any disabled people in the gym. Mm. So I thought that there needs to be kind of more inclusivity in gyms. I actually gave up in the end of trying to get a job in the gym, and I ended up working in Morrison's. And then a job came up working on a reception in the gym. So I thought, oh, I'll do that. At least it's in a gym environment.
Yeah.
I'll give it a go. And it just happened by luck. I was still trying to get jobs in gyms and I was still getting turned down. And it just happened to, in the gym that I was working reception at, one of the instructors called in sick and couldn't make it. And the manager was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're going to have to cancel this class. And there's about 40 people in this class. They're going to go crazy. I was like, well, I'm trained in teaching circuit and HIIT and boot camp. I'll teach it if you want. And she was just like, oh, thank you. Go and teach it. So I went up there. And this was kind of a moment where it could have gone great or could have absolutely failed for me. I walked in and I went, my name's Anne. I teach this, I teach that. I'm a para athlete. And they kind of just looked at me a bit funny and went, what, you're teaching? I was like, yeah. I've got all this experience, blah, blah, blah. And I turned around to put all the music on and set myself up. And behind me, they're all having conversations. I can hear them. And they're all going, oh, no, I'm not doing this. I actually want to do a workout today. I want to go to the gym instead. And I could hear it. And I was just like, don't listen. So I set my music up and I turned around. And out of 40 people, I think 25 of them left.
No way.
And this was a moment where I could have either thought, I'm an awful trainer. I don't want to do this. And I could have just got out there and got into my hole. But I was reading this book that kind of at that time was like, in every situation, try and think a positive outcome out of it. How can you look at that situation in a glass half full? And how I looked up, I saw 10 people had stayed. So I thought, I'm going to give these 10 people the best class they've ever had.
Yeah.
So I went really hard, pushed them, gave you every bit of information and exercises that I knew, made them sweat. And after that, they were like, that class was amazing. I think you're even better than the original teacher. And it just happened that that teacher was off for about a month. So I ended up covering that class every week. And after a few weeks, the word was starting to spread around the gym that this class was really good. And now my class is fully booked and it has waiting lists to try and get on my class now.
Do you know what? That goes with something my mum, Carol Kelsey, always says. Always wait for someone to be sick. Best way to advance your career.
Yeah, to be fair, that's worked for me as well.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry that happened to you though.
Yeah.
There are not many people in that situation who would have the, like, not only the mental resilience to go, no, I'm gonna show you, but also like that's such a like public situation to have to go,
yeah,
like, no, come on, I'm pulling myself together, or I'm carrying on here. Because like I think that's the thing with gyms as well. Like, gyms are intimidating.
They are.
So when you add on, when you add on being self-conscious, because I'm guessing they're not that adapted for people with disabilities either. No. That is like a really intimidating environment. So if there is anyone listening to this or watching this who is disabled or is struggling to go in the gym, what would your advice be?
When you go into the gym, don't think, oh, everyone's staring at me. Oh, I feel out of place. And what I've learned is people in the gym love to see someone absolutely pushing himself to the limits, no matter how you look, whether you're in a wheelchair or not, or if you have obesity or not. If you're working super hard, everyone in that gym is going to support you. And you might think they're staring, but they're probably just 9 times out of 10, they're staring thinking, wow, look at that guy go. That was something with me. I was always embarrassed of going in the gym. And what I found was, guys were coming up to me in the end going, how do you do that? That's incredible.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I always thought, oh, this is embarrassing. But I was just doing like one arm pull-ups thinking, oh, I look terrible. But
whereas you've got guys who are probably struggling to do a one arm pull-up going yeah. like, oh, I want to know how to do that.
I mean, I've had like some of the biggest guys in the gym that have muscles out of everywhere going, you're probably the strongest guy in this gym.
Yeah.
And I was like, that means a lot to me.
Must feel great. Yeah. I get similar things.
Well, I was going to say, I think yeah, me and Rick should come along yeah, to one of your exercise yeah. classes. You can put us through your paces.
Why are you such a sweaty pink mess?
Is that right now or in an exercise
generally.
Class? Generally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And thanks so much for coming in.
That's okay.
It's been amazing to meet him, hasn't it?
Absolutely incredible. Like,
so much to talk about. Really.
Yeah, there's so much. And you're such a huge inspiration. I feel like we need to do a second one of these.
This is all because you stalked Ant at a run club.
I did. You came along to one of our run clubs, yeah. which was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and I have to have a conversation to see if I can get involved. And he was like, come along to our podcast.
Yeah, 100%. Well, thank you so much for coming along and speaking to us. And huge, huge best of luck with what's next. I'm excited to see Time Machine 10 years time. Ultramarathon
yes.
Ant.
Oh, yes. Oh, God. Yeah.
Good luck, Ant. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You might be wondering, did he do it? And we are so pleased and happy to say that Ant Bryant did it. He is a Guinness World Record holder and London Marathon 2024 finisher.
Yeah, he holds the world record for running the marathon despite being paralysed down one side of their body. And he did it in 5 hours and 49 minutes. Well done, Ant.
Incredible. And I can't wait to see what's next.